This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. France is the latest European nation to toughen coronavirus controls, imposing a curfew in Paris and 8 other cities in step with the restrictions across the continent. Elsewhere, Spain has become the coronavirus hotspot in Western Europe, and the head of one of intensive care units in Madrid says his staff is already mentally exhausted. We get more from Reuters' Joe Davies.
With close to 900,000 registered infections and more than 33,000 deaths, Spain has become the coronavirus hotspot in Western Europe. At Madrid's Infanta Sevilla Hospital, emotional fatigue has already set in among intensive care staff, on a level even worse than in the first wave in the spring. And that's despite the fact they're better prepared now. Since Spain exited a tough lockdown in June, the infection rate has soared, with more than 10,000 cases diagnosed daily since August.
That's Reuters' Joe Davies reporting. With over 1 million coronavirus deaths and nearly 40 million cases worldwide, regions like Europe that suppressed the first outbreak are again facing tough choices on how to control a new wave without economically destructive national lockdowns. The International Monetary Fund is projecting a deep global recession in 2020 because of COVID-19, with global economies expected to shrink just over 4%. U.S. President Donald Trump's 14-year-old son, Barron, tested positive for COVID-19 but exhibited no symptoms after both of his parents contracted the virus. First Lady Melania Trump says Barron has since tested negative for the virus. Thai riot police cleared thousands of protesters from outside the prime minister's office early Thursday as an emergency decree banned large gatherings and the publication of sensitive news in the face of escalating protest. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling for cooperation between leaders to end fierce clashes over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. And the Kremlin says that he made the comment during a telephone call with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. In the U.S. Senate's final questioning, U.S. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett is telling skeptical Democrats she'd keep an open mind in rulings. More from AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Like yesterday, Barrett's refusing to give details about how she'd approach landmark cases on health care, abortion, and issues like voting rights.
I would, of course, have an open mind about it.
Still, Democrats tried to pin her down, like when Patrick Leahy asked about President Trump's view that he can pardon himself.
It's not one on which I can offer a view.
The GOP-led Senate's racing toward quickly confirming Barrett, whom Lindsey Graham calls a trailblazer for female conservatives.
And she's going to the court.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
President Trump Wednesday sought to shore up support for constituencies that not long ago he thought were secure. In a morning address to business leaders, he expressed puzzlement that they would even consider supporting his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, arguing that his own leadership was a better bet for a strong economy. Later, the president held his third campaign rally in 3 nights, this time in Iowa, a state he won handily in 2016, but where Biden is making a late push. Earlier, Biden held a virtual fundraiser from Wilmington, Delaware, and delivered recorded remarks to American Muslims. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is encouraging Saudi Arabia to recognize Israel and what would be a huge boost for the Jewish state and amid normalization by two other Gulf Arab kingdoms, Bahrain, which tightly coordinates its policies with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on September 15th. Signed the so-called Abraham Accords with Israel at the White House. The United States has approved a lab-made antibody treatment against the Ebola virus developed by the biotech firm Regeneron after it was shown to significantly reduce the mortality rate in a clinical trial. The drug was developed using the same technology platform that the company used to produce its experimental therapy against COVID-19. Of the patients who received the treatment, nearly 34% died after 28 days. That's compared to 51% of the patients who received a control drug. The Afghan government says two military helicopters evacuating wounded soldiers from fighting in southern Afghanistan collided Wednesday, killing 9 people on board. Afghanistan's defense ministry said the collision was due to technical issues. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan police Wednesday raided opposition leader Bobi Wine's party offices.
They have taken paraphernalia, that is red berets, t-shirts. They have taken documents. They also broke into Honorable Chagulanyi's office, which had many sensitive documents.
Also in Uganda, the Chief Justice makes a candy revelation about term limit. Thousands of Botswana students are taking their final exams this week amid concerns over rise in COVID-19 cases. Supporters of Cameroonian asylum seekers decry U.S. deportation. And a South Sudan rebel group signs its cessation of hostilities agreement in principle with the South Sudan government.
We are crying for our people that there should be peace. We know that whenever there is a conflict, conflict cannot end through another conflict. The end to the conflict is always negotiated.
And there are concerns about overfishing of the coast of Gambia. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan security forces on Wednesday raided offices of the opposition National Unity Platform Party of musician-turned-politician Bobi Wine. Wine says officers took documents, branding materials, and security cameras in what he called intimidation ahead of next year's election. Ugandan police say they were targeting the illegal use of army uniforms. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Armed with dough cutters, AK-47 guns, tear gas canisters and batons, a joint security operation of the police and military stormed offices of the National Unity Platform Party in Kampala Wednesday. Roads leading to party offices were cut off as police parked huge trucks in front. Security officers immediately began to force open doors and take items from inside. They later asked members of the party to sign for what was taken. Joel Senyonyi, the National Unity Platform spokesperson, says the officers took items from the office of party leader Robert Chagulanyi, better known by his stage name Bobi Wine.
They have taken paraphernalia, that is red berets, t-shirts. They have taken documents. So we are still trying to establish exactly. They also broke into Honorable Chagulanyi's office, which had many sensitive documents. We were preparing to take his signatures that we have collected from different parts of the country to the Electoral Commission on Friday, and many of those documents are now missing.
In a written statement, Enanga Fred, the Uganda police spokesperson, says police are targeting all locations illegally manufacturing, supplying, distributing, selling, and using uniforms and accoutrements whose ownership and patented designs belong exclusively to the armed forces. Police have not responded to accusations that they took election-related documents during the raid. Ugandan political analyst Anna Mary Nafuka says the raid was ill-advised and will promote the NUP party while making President Yoweri Museveni look paranoid.
It just gives NUP more visibility and more publicity. And you know the youth. Your allegations are not going to change anything they think about NUP or people power. So they will look at you like, then there is something there. But it looks like the big man fears them more than he should.
Aspiring candidates for parliament are due to present their credentials and nomination fees to the Electoral Commission beginning Thursday. It is not clear how candidates from the National Unity Platform will submit their forms if police have their documents. Uganda goes to the polls early next year to elect new legislators and the next president. Bobi Wine is expected to challenge Museveni, who has ruled Uganda for 34 years. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Ugandan Chief Justice Alphonse Oweni Dolo says he regrets the removal of presidential term limits from the Constitution. He told the Daily Monitor in an interview that the 1994 Constituency Assembly, which he was part of, did not establish the safeguards to stop such amendments. The Chief Justice said he and other members of the Constituent Assembly take responsibility for not entrenching the provision so that if they wanted to amend the particular article, it had to be done through a referendum. Anthony Weseka is a reporter with the Ugandan Daily Monitor and one of the authors of the article about the Chief Justice's comments.
The Chief Justice's revelation has not taken Ugandans by surprise.
Majority feel they were cheated by him. You know, he led a panel of five just to the Constitutional Court. That was about 2 years ago. And by then, he was the Deputy Chief Justice, where he presided over a constitutional petition in which concerned Ugandans and politicians were challenging the removal of the age limit clauses from the Constitution, that is Article 102B, which they felt was the last safeguard against the next president of Mr. Museveni. So they feel he should have stood up with the federal judges, annulled this amendment to remove the only remaining safeguard in the Constitution.
The Chief Justice says in your article that, I'm quoting him now, "I don't think this thing of age limit was a big issue, but what I wept for this country was for the removal of the presidential term limit. This is where we lost it." That is a profound statement. It seems that he feels a burden in terms of the impact of that decision.
Basically, what was saying that was that who felt cheated by his fellow judges in regard to the upholding of the age limit amendment, saying they should have cried more about the removal of the term limits instead of the age limit. He says his view was that that was most fundamental. He said he takes no responsibility, and also other members of the Constituent Assembly at that time, that was 1994, not have put in stricter safeguards in order to amend and remove that safeguard of the term limits.
Uganda goes to the presidential election next year. Does the Chief Justice feel that this particular decision is going to weigh heavily, not only on him, but the country as a whole, considering the country goes to an election, and maybe that this has created a lifetime presidency?
Yeah, sure. He regrets it, and he says basically Ugandans should come out and advocate or lobby for bringing back of their term limits. They shouldn't cry over the age limits. But the bigger thing, they should look at the bigger thing, which is the term limits, have them restored in the Constitution so that whoever comes can rule for only 2 terms. Just like our neighbors, the Kenyans, Tanzanians, and then also the Rwandese.
Anthony Weseka is a reporter with the Ugandan Daily Monitor. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. South Sudan's government and rebels of the South Sudan Opposition Movements Alliance this week agreed in principle in Rome to cease hostilities. The group, which comprises Thomas Cirilo's National Salvation Front, has yet to sign the 2018 peace agreement. Deng Yang Vanek is the spokesperson for the South Sudan Opposition Movements Alliance. He says the group came to the negotiating table not because it wants positions in the current revitalized transitional government of national unity, but because it is more concerned about the suffering of South Sudanese.
We met the government for 4 days in Rome discussing 2 documents. One being their commitment to the cessation of hostilities agreement. The cessation of hostilities was signed in 2017 in the Khartoum agreement, which has not been fully implemented. It has gone through a lot of violations and counter-violations by both the government and the rebel groups which have signed the Khartoum peace agreement, which is the revitalized peace agreement. We feel the need for the recommitment to the COA because it has been violated separately by the government.
Now, does this agreement entail or it means now that you will try to have a place in the revitalized transitional government of national unity?
We did not sign that agreement on COA simply because we want to join that government, because we cannot join that government because that government now is not fully operational. This is the reason that the government, which is IG, SPLM IG government, that is refusing to implement any peace it signs with any rebel group. And it is the same story going on. The agreement is not being implemented. Even those who are in the government now are not doing anything. And if that agreement is falling apart and the government is falling apart, what are we going to do? We are going to do nothing. That's why we insist that Rome initiative, the Rome Peace Initiative, is the only solution that will solve the problem of the whole South Sudan.
I guess maybe South Sudanese want to know what motivated you to want to sign this ceasefire. Could it be that maybe your fighting forces are now, maybe they're having trouble with the government forces that you are forced to sign?
What motivates us is that our South Sudanese people are suffering. They are subjected to a lot of suffering by the failed government of Juba. But on our side, we see that it is possible to negotiate a peace agreement, a peace deal, peacefully, rather than resorting to devastating conflict, which makes the life of each and every ordinary South Sudanese difficult. That is our first priority. And that is the reason why we reach out to Rome with send video to ensure that the COA that has been violated by the government should be reinstated to be a workable solution that can cease the raging fire in South Sudan, so that we move towards negotiating a solution based on the root causes of the conflict.
I'm wondering, how effective are your fighting forces inside South Sudan? I'm asking this question because could it be that you signed this agreement because you figured the fighting tide has turned against you?
No, not at all. It's not the case. We are crying for our people that there should be peace. We know that whenever there is a conflict, conflict cannot end through another conflict. The end to the conflict is always negotiated. And we are not desperate for it because we are being defeated on the ground. Our position is very strong against the government. And if our position is not strong, the government could not accept to talk to us. The government talks to us because it knows that we are very strong.
Deng Yang Vanek is spokesperson for the South Sudan Opposition Movements Alliance. You are speaking with us from Brussels, Belgium. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Robert in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 15. This week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Imazap, a mixture of three monoclonal antibodies made by Regeneron. This is the first FDA-approved treatment for Ebola virus infection in adult and pediatric patients following a U.S. government-supported trial and expanded access protocol in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said the approval of the first-ever therapeutic for Ebola is a momentous global health achievement that would have never occurred without American leadership. He said the Trump administration made ending the 2018 Ebola outbreak one of its top global health priorities for the last 2 years. Supporters of a group of Cameroonian asylum seekers who entered the United States illegally decried their expected deportation yesterday, Wednesday, saying they could face persecution back home. Some in Cameroon say some of those seeking asylum instigated violence in the country's separatist conflict and should face charges. But as Moki Edwin Kizika reports from the city of Douala, state media are putting a positive spin on the return.
More than 20 Cameroonians gathered Wednesday at the Douala International Airport to await relatives expected to be deported from the United States. 27-year-old Jennifer Monet says she fears her older brother will be at risk if he is forced back to Cameroon. Last year, she says, he fled fighting in Cameroon's Anglophone separatist conflict.
You are either afraid of separatist fighters or you are afraid of the military. And leaving these regions and going to the Francophone parts of Cameroon, they look at you as a separatist, and leaving Cameroon and going to the U.S. to seek asylum, and yet they want you back in Cameroon where you don't have peace, you don't have any freedom, really. It's a violation of human rights.
Moni says she is looking for another country that will accept her and her brother. Cameroon's government has not confirmed the deportations or expected arrivals. But State Cameroon Radio Television, CRTV, this week reported that a chartered flight was expected Wednesday from Dallas, Texas, with 126 deported asylum seekers on board. CRTV reported 86 of them were Cameroonians and the rest were believed to be from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In August, government led protests in front of the U.S. Embassy in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, called for Washington to either charge or deport Cameroonians who allegedly were backing Anglophone rebels. Activist Hilda Manga participated in the protests and says those who were deported from the U.S. should be investigated and punished if they supported the separatists.
That is a great initiative which must be applauded, because it is high time they are sent home to face charges and answer to the crimes they have committed. They should return home and let's see how together we can put an end to this crisis that has kept the masses suffering for four good years.
Cameroon's state media gave no indication as to when the asylum seekers would face arrest and put a positive spin on their return. CRTV said they were needed to help rebuild Cameroon and that authorities had sent medical experts to take care of them before, during and after their deportation. Alexandra Lamarche works with the group Refugees International as a senior advocate for West and Central Africa. She says the deportations are appalling.
In the case of many Cameroonians seeking asylum in the U.S., they have fled the country fearing attacks from the government. Many are from the conflict-ridden Anglophone region or supported opposition parties or have been vocal about the authorities' poor human rights track record. Regardless of why they came, most of them will undoubtedly face retaliatory attacks from the government upon their return.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, as a policy, does not comment on deportations until after they have occurred. The Cameroonians entered the U.S. last year via South America and Mexico. The administration of President Donald Trump has been cracking down on illegal immigrants and making it harder for asylum claims to be approved. Fighting broke out in 2016 after Cameroon's military cracked down on Anglophones calling for an independent state within the mainly French-speaking country. Cameroon's English speakers say they are treated as second-class citizens and given fewer jobs and support from the state. The United Nations says more than 3,000 people have been killed in Cameroon's separatist conflicts and half a million others displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
Thousands of students in Botswana began taking their final exams this week amid concerns over a rise in COVID-19 cases in schools and the impact of disrupted education. Reporter Kundise Dube has details from Haburuni.
Dr. Yuan Machi, the UN Children's Fund representative for Botswana, says as many as 90,000 students have been affected by the pandemic. Some are doing their exams in quarantine and isolation centers. This comes after Botswana saw a surge in the number of reported COVID-19 cases in schools. Machi said even after the country lifted its lockdown restrictions in May, some children were struggling to return to class. This week, the COVID-19 Task Force Coordinator, Professor Musibili Musibili, said COVID-19 cases in schools have stabilized. However, education sector unions say it's apparent COVID disrupted lessons. The Bofebuso Secretary General, Tabokani Rari, explains.
It also points to issues of floppiness on the side of the Minister of Basic Education. It will then point to the issues of uniformity. There would not be any uniformity. Other students will be taught and others will not be taught. And as a teacher, I think you would not want to deal with such a situation.
Basic Education Permanent Secretary Bridget John said the examinations are progressing well with strict adherence to COVID-19 protocols at examination centers across the country. However, parents like Gaelo Marubing argue COVID-19 has affected learning and examinations should have been postponed.
If you look at it, our children were not able to do extra lessons in preparation for the examinations, as some had to go for isolation. This affected their program and will likely affect their results. As we speak, some are still in isolation. It is not an ideal situation.
The World Health Organization has urged the safe reopening of schools in Africa. Most countries opted to reopen exam classes, while in Botswana, all students are back in school after lockdown restrictions were lifted. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
An African Union, European Union summit will take place later this month, and artisanal fishing activists hope the meeting will address critical issues within the fishing industry. Dawud Asin, Secretary General of the African Confederation of Artisanal Fishing Organizations, spoke with Ricky Stryak about overfishing off the coast of Gambia.
The fisheries in West Africa in general is faced with very serious challenges in terms of, you know, infrastructure capacity, such as the vessel, how do you monitor our fishing activities that are within, because most of the time we do give out licensing, but we don't have the capacity to monitor the activities of these vessels. This is a problem that I think most of our West African, especially those within the Sub-Regional Fisheries Commission.
Earlier this year, for example, Senegal rejected around 50 licenses out of, I believe, 54 applications. How does that compare to Gambia and Guinea-Bissau's fishing licenses?
Yeah, because even if you look at the Gambian fishing license in general, we are talking about more than 100 fishing vessels. Too much here in the Gambia, because I think we have more than 100 fishing licenses issued. And this includes those within the Senegal or Gambia fishing agreement. This is the reciprocal agreement, as well as also joint fishing agreements from those with the Chinese having agents in the Gambia. So I think in total, we are talking about more than 100% vessels, out of which I think 70% of them are actually owned.
I know a lot of people talk about Chinese boats, but what about the EU's role? Because, you know, in places like Guinea-Bissau, for example, there are Spanish boats, there are Portuguese boats that are also fishing a lot off of the waters.
We have what we call the EU-Gambia Sustainable Fisheries Agreement, which was signed and entered into, but I think, I don't know, because to be very frank with you, there has not been any information regarding whether this vessel or this agreement have been started.
The AU-EU summit is scheduled for the end of October. What do groups like yourselves, which represent the need for more protections for artisanal fisheries, what do you guys hope comes out of this summit in later October when it comes to regulations that ensure these artisanal fishers have access to the resources, you know, they have lived with for a very long time?
Yeah, I think it's very important because there is a document that was, you know, agreed upon, that was adopted at the FAO summit in 2020, FAO coffee meeting, the FAO meeting on fisheries, and this is the voluntary guidelines for securing sustainable small-scale fisheries in the context of food security and poverty eradication. This is a document dedicated specifically for artisanal fishers, and it talks about how artisanals are going to be protected. It talks about the issue of taking into account food security, also talking about the plight of artisanal fishers in order to be able to access information, joint. These are a lot of, you know, in terms of the value chain, in terms of, you know, reserving, you know, stocks for artisanal fishers.
That was Dawud Asin, Secretary General of the African Confederation of Artisanal Fishing Organizations. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Banjul. And that's it for this Thursday, October 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a great day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important after news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.